Good day. It is Pastor Chip Anderson, and the following message is for the June 7th Scattered Church Service. It will be our 12th of the messages during this COVID-19 lockdown time. And our text this morning is Romans 1, 18 through 23 as we march through the book of Romans this year. I had just been approaching 50 years old, and two significant things happened to me. I met my biological father, and I had my first echocardiogram of my heart. There was something in common with these two events. Of course, I cannot adequately express the joy and excitement and meeting. For the first time since I was 1 year old, my father, my biological father. It was a great and grand Easter weekend, getting introduced to my family and especially to my father. Brothers and a sister, and plenty of nieces and nephews. But one thing finally happened after 5 decades of wondering. Whenever I would fill out our medical history forms, my medical history forms, I could only put down what I knew from my mother's lineage. I had to put down things like not accessible for my father's medical history. I simply did not know. I knew I had a father. I perceived that much, but was unaware of any medical history. Didn't know if cancer, heart disease, diabetes, high blood pressure, or anything that would be needed to be addressed. At that first meeting, I began to find out, and in the short months to come, what kind of medical history my father brought to my body, to my person. As I was nearing my 50th birthday, my doctor wanted to run a cardiogram stress test for me. I've had a couple of these before, just to see how I was doing on blood pressure and heart matters. Like I said, I've had them before, but the doc this time, this was a milestone testing time, coming up to age 50. So I went in and had the treadmill stress test, did fine. But the attending tech person asked if I had ever had an echocardiogram. You know, using sound to see my heart. I said, no, never had one. And then there I was on a table, chest hair shaved, and a nurse or tech person checking me like I was pregnant. After a few moments, she asked me if anyone ever told me I had a heart defect. Of course, my heart stopped, figuratively, of course. I said, no, no one has ever mentioned it. A slight murmur every once in a while, but doctors always told me that was normal. But no doctor or family member ever mentioned a heart defect since birth. In 50 years. The nurse said, I have a bicuspid aortic valve defect, which is an aortic valve that only has two leaflets, I call them flaps, two flaps, instead of three, which is normal. I had the defect since birth, didn't know it, but eventually it would get the best of me, be a problem toward the end of my life. My doc said, probably in my 70s, if I lived that long. But like my father's family medical history, which I had, no matter if I knew it or not, I also had a heart defect since birth that I had not known about. A defect that, in the end, would be problematic in some way. Real-life illustrations never totally illustrate spiritual and biblical truths, but these two come mighty close. What Paul is now going to tell us in our text in Romans 1, 18 through 23, and on through really to the end of chapter 3, God's wrath is upon us, and we, humankind, each one of us, has been marked by sin, and whether we know it or not, this will be problematic in the end for each of us. Each of us have an eternal death sentence upon us, whether we know it or not. Paul has shared some pretty darn good news that this gospel is for salvation to everyone who believes, cutting across any and all ethnic, social, and cultural divisions, inequities, and barriers. And that in this gospel is revealed God's righteousness and keeping his word and covenant loyalty. We like to call this good news. Now in our next text this morning in Romans 1, 18 through 23, we learn some bad news. But strangely enough, it is still good news because it is part of the gospel. That in this gospel, God's wrath against all ungodliness and injustice is revealed. And most just don't know it yet. We have the defect of sin, and it will be problematic for us in the end. Let me read the text. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, has been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world, in the things that have been made, so they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and foolish in their hearts. Their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creepy things. Let's remember one important thing. This is written to us, to the church, not necessarily to the pagan, non-believer, unchurched. This is often preached that way. This is often preached evangelistically as if a club on top of the head of the pagan, the non-believer, the unchurched. But this is to us, to the church. This has missional overtones for us. It goes back to why Paul is writing to explain this gospel, his gospel, to the house churches in Rome. To preach the gospel to us. Ed Stetzer, a leading church planter thinking guy, recently wrote, "A broken world needs an on-mission church. A broken world needs an on-mission church." Interestingly, that is why I believe Paul wrote the letter to the house churches in Rome, to get the church on board its mission. In our confession, the Presbyterian Church in America, our confession, the Westminster Confession of Faith, in the Catechism, we are asked a question. It comes to us in question number 23. What offices does Christ fill as our Redeemer? And the answer is, Christ as our Redeemer fills the offices of a prophet, of a priest, and of a king in his states both of humiliation, that's his manhood, and exaltation after he rose from the dead. Then we are asked about what it means for Jesus to be a prophet and a priest. And the one I'm interested in here is question 26. How does Christ fill the office of a king? Christ fills the office of a king is the answer. Christ fills the office of a king in making us his willing subjects, in ruling and defending us, and in restraining and conquering all his and our enemies. Now, this is important. I think it's important because this is exactly how Paul starts in Romans chapter 1. Jesus is the Son of God, the King that God set upon his throne. Yes, of course, it is Christ as priest that brings about our salvation, but it is that king position, that king office that I want to highlight to help us understand what Paul means that our gospel also reveals the wrath of God. We don't want a king to act like a priest and bring salvation, which is a good thing, that reveals his righteousness, his standard, his character, his ability to keep his word, without the ability to make things right by judging and passing sentence on what has made everything a mess in the first place. So we want a king that can restrain and conquer all his and our enemies, and I don't think I'm wrong to say our last enemy is death. We need a king that is powerful enough not only to point out sin as he does as prophet, but a king that adequately can deal with the messes and consequences of sin in terms of righteousness between people and injustice, because that's exactly what Paul is talking about. Let's start how all this fits together by rereading Paul's personal history and his ministry introduction in verses 8 through 18. Just be patient. We've read this a couple of times. Paul writes first, "I thank my God through Jesus Christ for you all, because your faith is proclaimed in all the world. Why? Because God is my witness, whom I serve with my spirit in the gospel of his Son, that without ceasing I make mention of you, always in my prayers, asking that somehow by God's will I may now at last succeed in coming to you. Why? Because I long to see you, that I may impart to you some spiritual gift to strengthen you. That is, that we may be mutually encouraged by each other's faith, both yours and mine." Verse 13, "I do not want you to be unaware, brothers, that I have often intended to come to you, but thus far have been prevented, in order that I may reap some harvest among you, as well as among the rest of the Gentiles. I am under obligation both to the Greeks and to the barbarians, both to the wise and to the foolish, so I am eager to preach the gospel to you also who are in Rome. Why? Because I am not ashamed of the gospel. 16a. Why? Because the gospel has power to save everyone who believes. 116b. Why? Because the gospel reveals the righteousness of God. 117. And why? Because the righteousness, because the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all unrighteousness. 118. So what's going on here in the text? Let's just follow the text this morning. The first thing is, for the wrath of God is revealed against from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. The first thing I want you to notice is this is about the relationships between human beings that this wrath of God has been revealed against all ungodliness. That's ungodly behavior. That word unrighteousness of men is injustice of men. That's the injustice between human beings who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. The revelation of God's wrath is in some way connected to the revelation of God's righteousness. Same exact words in both are used, verse 17 and 18. Both begin with for, that gar, that Greek word G-A-R, gar, that I translate why, because. In verse 17, for righteousness of God, and I'm trying to give it as close to the word order as possible, for righteousness of God in it, the gospel, is revealed, apocalypto. And then verse 18, for, there's that gar word, starts off there. For revealed, apocalypto. Revealed, wrath of God. You got to see these as parallel. They're intentionally parallel. Both are helping to clarify what Paul means that he wants to preach this gospel to the house churches in Rome. The gospel he is not ashamed of, because it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes. Why? Because in the gospel is revealed God's righteousness. Why? Because in it the gospel is revealed God's wrath. These two together explaining God's salvation would not be strange to those hearing this letter read, especially to the Jewish believers. For there is an Old Testament pairing of God's righteousness and God's wrath to bring about salvation to his people throughout the Old Testament. The cross of Christ itself is that place where the righteous promises of God have come to place, and the place where God's wrath came upon sin on behalf of yours and mine, where God's wrath was poured out upon sin. The verbs there revealed, apocalypto, are present tense. So the idea is God's righteousness is being revealed wherever faith is found, and God's wrath is being revealed upon all forms of ungodliness and injustice. These are something happening even now, but more on that in a moment. Don't you hate it? Don't you dislike it a lot when someone tells you they forgive you, but doesn't tell you what for? Doesn't that just get you? I've had people come up to me and say they forgive me, and I said, what for? And they said, just because, you know, they don't really have something to say. I'm wondering why. What did I do to offend you? Doesn't it bother you when someone tells you that you're wrong or you've behaved wrongly, but doesn't tell you exactly what you've done to deserve punishment or judgment? The gospel, the preaching of the gospel, verse 15, not only tells us that Jesus brings salvation to those who believe and that God has kept his word, the preaching of the gospel also tells us what's wrong with us. Psalm 110, verses 5 through 7, uplifts God's chosen king. But listen to this. The Lord is at your right hand. He will shatter kings on the day of his wrath. He will execute judgment upon the nations, filling them with corpses. He will shatter chief over the wide earth. He will drink from the brook by the way. Therefore, he will lift up his head. This is a psalm about the installment of God's king. And here's another installment passage, Psalm 2, 6 through 9. As for me, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill. I will tell of the decree. The Lord said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I will make the nations your inheritance and the ends of the earth your possession. You shall break them with an iron rod and dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. Isaiah 41, 8-11, salvation includes wrath. But you, Israel, my servant Jacob, whom I have chosen, the offspring of Abraham, my friend, you whom I took from the ends of the earth, and call from its farthest corners, saying to you, you are my servant. I have chosen you and not cast you off. Fear not, for I am with you. Be not dismayed, for I am your God and will strengthen you. I will help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. Behold, all who are incensed against you shall be put to shame. And confounded, those who strive against you shall be as nothing and shall perish. Salvation and God's wrath together. Isaiah 59:17 and 18. He has put on a righteousness. He has put on righteousness as a breastplate and a helmet of salvation on his head. For he put on garments of vengeance for clothing and wrapped himself in zeal as a cloak according to their deeds. So he will repay. Wrath to his adversaries, repayment to his enemies, to the close lands he will render repayment. Salvation, righteousness, and garments of vengeance, all together. And then the famous, where we often term and say, the good news is only limited to what Jesus has brought to us in salvation. But the problem is, there is more. There is more. And there is no hermeneutic to suggest that we are not to take this passage as a whole. Isaiah 61, 1 through 3. Vengeance without, without vengeance, there is no comfort. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because the Lord has anointed me to bring good news. There it is, the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted and to proclaim liberty to the captives and the opening of the prison to those who are bound. And to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor and the day of vengeance of our God. Romans 1:16, 17, 18, right there. And the day of vengeance of our God to comfort all who mourn. To grant to those who mourn in Zion to give them a beautiful headdress instead of ashes and the oil of gladness instead of mourning. The garment of praise instead of a faint spirit. That they may be called oaks of righteousness, the planting of the Lord, that he may be glorified. So how does God's good news contain such bad news as judgment and wrath? I did just give you some verses to strongly suggest that that's biblical. But I also think it's our misunderstanding and mistranslating of the word gospel into English as good news. Now, there's nothing wrong with that translation. That's actually what it does mean. It's the combination of good message, good proclaiming a message. We got that. Giving it a more bland notion, however, than the word's intent as a sign of victory, a sign of conquering. This is what a king would declare upon destroying his enemies. Euangelion, that's the Greek word, you've heard it said before, means glad tidings, a good message, but it has the idea of victorious announcement. It was good news that kings would receive, that their battles have won them the victory. It was good news. It was a victorious announcement when Caesar would declare that he was born on such a day and rose to power on another day because it was his victory over the realms of man. Isaiah 49 through 10, you know it. Go up on a high mountain, O Zion, herald of good news. Lift up your voice with strength, O Jerusalem, herald of good news. Lift it up, fear not. Say to the cities of Judah, behold your God. Behold, the God, the Lord God comes with might, and his arm rules for him. Behold, his reward is with him, and his recompense before him. And then a minor prophet, Nahum 1:14 through 2:2. The Lord has given commandment about you. No more shall your name be perpetuated. From the house of your gods I will cut off the carved image and the metal image. You can see almost the background of our text here. I will make your grave, for you are vile. Behold, upon the mountains the feet of him who brings good news, who publishes peace. Keep your feasts, O Judah. This is a song of victory. Fulfill your vows, for never again shall the worthless pass through you. He is utterly cut off. The scatterer has come up against you. Man the ramparts, watch the road, dress for battle. Collect all your strength, for the Lord is restoring the majesty of Jacob as the majesty of Israel, for the plunderers have plundered them and ruined their branches. And so now we come to number two, for what can be known about God is plain to them. This is one of those rare occasions that the English word for actually isn't the gar word. It is diototē, or because. And there is something parallel going on with verse 19 and 21 because they begin basically the same way. They begin both with diototi, because, and then they are followed with the subject of the knowledge of God, knowing God. Verse 19, because the knowing, what can be known, literally the known of God. And then verse 21, because knowing God, not as God. So you have to see them as parallel. So they will function that way. We are not told here what it is that is known, but verse 20 will explain what is clearly perceived by mankind. And we'll get to that in a second. The first gar that comes right after that. And so basically we have the idea that because the knowledge of God, the knowing of God manifested is among them. Why is this? Because God has shown it to them, has shown what can be known. God has made himself known. Now, many people turn to this text and this passage to talk about natural revelation. There's plenty of Psalms that talk about how the mountains and the suns and the stars all speak of God, and they do. This is not that subject that I want to cover right now, but there's enough in creation to know that God exists. The mere fact that we believe, or that anyone believes, there is a right and wrong, a good or bad, good and bad, should at least give us the general idea that something is all behind this creation. Ethics are not part of our DNA, but ethics, the idea of right and wrong, is built into our soul, into our created image part. Knowing right or wrong, and here I mean the idea that there is a right and wrong, tells us something, makes us this way, tells us there's something behind this. What we know of God, the creator of creation, is perceived by us. Not totally understood, not in detail. It doesn't tell us exactly what's going on with the revelation, the special revelation of God, but it does tell us that we are accountable to a creator. But it is God who made that perception, this perception, possible. That's what this tells us. God is at the center, whereas all other forms of knowing are man-centered. Remember, Paul is telling the church this. This, the believers in Rome, that this is not being explained to non-believers. This is what he wants the church to understand. Why? Because his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made. So it is the creation, and it is that there is a creator God behind creation. Up until the Enlightenment, and if you're a little bit of a history buff, you know what the Enlightenment is. It has affected us all in some way or another. It's a marking of time where they started thinking differently about the world. Most humans up to that time thought, human thought began with the premise, I believe, therefore I know. This is pretty simple. I believe, therefore I know. The time of the Enlightenment turned that on its head, and now we are to believe, which is funny, that I know, therefore I believe. This can be a whole topic in and of itself. Just note, we live in a time when we need to know first, right? It has to be proven, has to be seen, has to be examined before we believe anything. But that new enlightened premise is built on the old premise before you even get to the more modern premise. You have to believe first in knowing and knowledge, which I think is somewhat ironic and very often unacknowledged. So our text in Romans, where God is perceived by us, we ought not think that a strange thing, for much of history has always had some inkling that there was God. You can as a missionary buff that I am, you can go to almost any place on the planet, and there are people who believe. And obviously, general revelation, not specific revelation. I get that. This explains often what we understand about God ourselves, but it also helps all of the tribes and nations and tongues understand their small g gods as well. But why is this all here? No one in Paul's day would have argued against natural revelation. That is what nature tells us about God in general. Nature even explains to the Gentile world about their gods. But here's the problem. Here's what Paul says. So they are without excuse. General revelation perceived by man is enough to show us that we're without excuse about righteousness and justice. What's interesting is that in Romans 2:1, Paul's going to remind us, therefore you have no excuse, O man, every one of you who judges. See, soon as you judge, you believe that there's a right and wrong, even if it's on the wrong standard. You believe there's a right or wrong. And if you judge, you are not without excuse. This leads us to the third one. And this comes from our because, DOT, right? Verse 21, although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. God has reasonably expected that those who are to bear his image would honor, that is, to glorify and thank him, to be grateful to him. In this context of God's self-manifestation of his person and nature, God making himself known, Paul uses for the first time that doxa, the glory terminology in this letter. And that's where he says they did not honor. And that's the word glorify him as God. There is no doubt there is in the Roman Empire a competition for honor, and it was visible in every city, in every place, on every street, in every building of the Roman Empire, which members of the elite competed for civic power through sponsoring games and celebrations and financing buildings and endowing food distributions. People looked for honor and to outdo the next person. This is why it was and is so easy to justify dehumanizing another, because we have not rid ourselves of seeking this glorification, this honor. The public life in the Roman Empire was centered on the quest for honor. I do not think it's that much different now, just the reasons for it. But we can discuss that at another time. So the Roman Empire was centered on the quest for honor. This leaves little doubt that Paul's understanding of glory, of honor, while being profoundly theological with Jewish background, was also very political. And it's polemic, it's defense, it's argument against social honoring, or what I would like to say, social honor gaining. The proper response to what God has created, of course, is gratefulness. But that's only narrowly explaining what's going on here. Paul has argued that there has been enough known about or of God for humankind to honor, to glorify God as God. There has been enough known about God or of God for us to render him thanks. This again is about honor shame. God has been shamed. His image has been tarnished because his image bearers do not honor him or give him thanks. Sin has shamed God. Parents know exactly what I'm talking about when our children bring us shame or bring on us shame or honor by what they do or don't do. You know this. However, the problem of humankind's face before God here is deeper and very explanatory of our condition as sinners without excuse, without face before God and our fellow humans. Remember, it is the wrath of God against the relationship's righteousness, the relationship's injustice of men. We have become, if you will, futile in our thinking, and our foolish hearts are darkened. The idea here, rendered foolish, it kind of means, if you will, foolish behavior that accomplishes nothing. Pointless, useless, worthless. You can hear the sense of shame here. Don't honor God all with behavior that dishonor God, that bring him shame. So the first thing here is the claiming to be wise, they became fools. This is a common Greek way of saying making a claim, some form of claim, but had no reasonable basis for that claim. Basically, what they are and do and say is just untrue. Remember, again, this is righteousness. This is the relationships between people. It is unrighteous behavior between people. It is injustice between people. And then B, and Paul explains this in verse 23, and namely, exchange the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creepy things. In other words, we have become like the gods we worship. Idols are foolish. They neither can see nor think. There is no reasoning power in an idol, so we become like them. Psalm 115, 4 through 8 tells us we become like what we worship. Do not think this is of another time or ancient language. We all know the idols that we have in our lives, and we become like them, whether it be power, money, sex, race, prestige, whether it be houses or rings or bling, we have idols. The point of Romans 1:23 is not the fall into sin of the pair in Genesis 3, but what has affected the Gentile population of humanity in that fall, because the exchange has always been happening, that they exchange the glory of the immortal God in terms of its failure because it did not fulfill its created purpose, mankind's purpose, Adam's purpose. Throughout the letter, doxa, glory, is used 15 times. The verb is used 16 times. So in the book of Romans, glory, honor, is used 21 times. It is obviously a center of the theme in Romans. What Paul says in Romans 3:23, that we lack the glory of God, when he calls us sinners, this is what it means. Basically, we have exchanged the glory of God for the image of the images of corruptible animals. Paul's description of Gentile waywardness. This is Paul's description of Gentile waywardness. The very language of Jewish descriptions of Gentile idolatry are being used here. Of Gentile immorality is being used here, but I think very specific in the area of honor seeking, which puts it literally in how we understand the text. Humanity's exchange of the glory of God in Romans 1:23 and falling short of the glory of God in Romans 3:23. This seems to argue for the references to a ruptured relationship with God, a relationship that is restored in glorification that we read about in Romans 8:30. Psalm 106:19-23. It's interesting. The Jewish world said this of breaking covenant. They made a calf in Horeb and worshipped a metal thing, a metal image. They exchanged the glory of God for the image of an ox that eats grass. They forgot God, their Savior, who has done great things in Egypt, wondrous works in the land of Ham, and awesome deeds by the Red Sea. Therefore, he said he would destroy them. Had not Moses, his chosen one, stood in the breach before him to turn away his wrath from destroying them. And it's repeated at the end of the Exodus, Deuteronomy 4:15-18. Therefore, watch yourselves very carefully, since you saw no form on that day that the Lord spoke to you at Horeb, out of the midst of fire. Beware lest you act corruptly by making a carved image of yourselves in the form of any figure, the likeness of male or female, the likeness of any animal that is on the earth, the likeness of any winged bird that flies in the air, like the likeness of anything that creeps on the ground, like the likeness of any fish that is on the water, in the water, under the earth. Reflecting on creation, we can see that Israel itself had to exchange the glory of God. What I believe Paul is driving at is what the Genesis chapter 1 and 2 suggest, what the cautions and warnings of being loyal to the covenant mean, what the psalmist meant reflecting on Israel's current place, is that they had not fulfilled the purpose God intended them, the purpose that he had described upon them in Genesis. Humanity is currently characterized by the opposite of these divine intentions. In Genesis 1:26-27, the plan was to rule his creation, God's creation. That's part of what it means to be made in the image of God. And instead, a reversal happens when they do not acknowledge or give him thanks. This aligns also with the theme of the gospel. The goal of the gospel is that all nations coming to the obedience of faith, 1:5, and that this gospel is the power of God for salvation to all who believe, quoting then again from the Hebrew text, from the Habakkuk text, 2:4, the righteous will live by his faith. It's interesting that Habakkuk 2:14 says, for the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. There is, even in the context of the minor prophet where Paul quotes, the idea of God's glory being stretched out to all under heaven as the waters cover the sea. The first thing here is, no doubt Paul has in mind the creation account, meaning that mankind has lost, as did Adam, the purpose, and as Israel did too, the purpose for which they have been created and stamped with God's image. They were to reign and rule over creation. Instead, creation rules over them. The second thing is, this salvation, this righteousness of God revealed, this wrath of God revealed, is all about God reorienting, writing humankind back to God's image-bearing purpose in what he created us for. There is a straight line I'd like to draw for you here. From exchange the glory of God for the image of creation in 1:23 to all have fallen or lack, which is a much better word, the glory of God, 3:23, to for I consider the things that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy compared with the glory that is to be revealed in us. For the creation waits eagerly longing for the revelation of God's sons. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willing, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in pains of childbirth until now. So we have a line going from 123 through 323 through 8, chapter 8, 18 through 22. And now right on to those famous words that we all treasure. And we know that those who are loved, who love God, all things work together for good, for those who are called according to his purpose, for those whom he foreknew. He also predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son, in order that he might be the firstborn among many brethren. And those whom he predestined, he glorified, he called, and those whom he called, he justified, and those who he justified, he also glorified. This is the restoration of the purpose, the missional aspect of God in this world. We exchange the glory of God for the glory of creation. We have become like the animals, thus losing our glory that we had from God, making it possible for all creation to come under a curse because we do not honor God as his image bearers. Yet believers are being transformed into the image of Christ, the one who fulfilled the purpose of God as the true image of God. And this thirdly leaves us. This makes sense in that there is bad news and good news in the gospel. I'd rather say a deconstructing and a constructing in the gospel. The gospel, as much as gives you what we are to be, it also deconstructs what we are. The gospel deconstructs us and constructs us. And how do I know this is true for the book of Romans? Well, I turn to Romans 14:6, because the fix is right there. We don't have to go very far. Paul actually applies all of this to the church in Rome. 14:6 says, "The one who observes the day observes it in honor of the Lord. The one who eats, eats in honor of the Lord, since he gives thanks to God. While the one who abstains, abstains in honor of the Lord and gives thanks to God." You can see that right there. The undoing of the curse is right there. The deconstruction has to happen, and we're going to talk about in more specific ways next week, so that the construction may happen. The gospel deconstructs, the gospel constructs. Paul wanted to be clear that humanity has failed to be the image of God and its creative purpose. Paul wants us to be the construction, the creation, the development of, the fulfillment of the righteousness, the image of Christ. I'm going a little long today because I want to stop and wait to the end to tell you what I think is happening with these verses. What I call a venue hermeneutic is so important. Why there is a lens to listen through. See, the supper of the Lord that we gather around a table now is a construct of the times. In the early church, it was all around an actual dinner table, or actual around a family gathered together, but not just a family of bloodline, family of strangers and unequals. And something transformed the early church, and it has been said, and I agree with it. It was that meal that people were invited to, where they learned of the gospel, they were taught the gospel, and they experienced the gospel right there. See, we can say that this is about Adam, this is about mankind in general, but there needs to be something like a hook to get us around. Real briefly, because I'll explain more next week. Before the church, if you will, adopted this venue, both in the Jewish home and the Gentile home. In the Gentile home, which is Paul definitely writing to, he is writing to a place where they would have gathered after a meal to dehumanize people. And Paul is trying to change that. Is it not a good thing that God is fair, that he is a fair God and a fair judge, that he reveals his justice by punishing sinners? Even Matthew and Mark record Jesus saying, "Repent, for the kingdom of God is at hand." There is a sense of repentance, the sense of knowing that we need to be deconstructed. In part, salvation, as we know, is freeing those who believe from the wrath of God to come. But Paul tells us, just as the righteousness of God appeared, so appears the wrath of God upon all ungodliness and injustice. How does this happen? By the small outposts of churches showing what it's like in its gathering together, in its activity, what it's like, what this righteousness is. Creation is all messed up. Idolatry not only messes up what we do, it messes up our interior and exterior lives. If you haven't figured that out this March, April, May, June, it is because our hearts are darkened. But we understand that everyone is under the sentence of death, even the non-believer. And this is a missional calling. Conform to the behaviors of the gospel so that the world might know that it has exchanged the glory of God for the image of creation. Thank you very much. A little long today, but this is a tough verse, tough set of verses, and it isn't gonna get easier. Amen.